Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, this is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks a lot for joining me for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. Over the next 20 minutes or so, we'll talk with Dr. Fred Buchholz about all things coronavirus and COVID-19. So let's get started. Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks for joining us again.
Always my pleasure.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, was on CNN and had a special message for those partygoers at the Lake of the Ozarks over Memorial Day weekend. I want you to hear what he said, and then I'll get your reaction to it. But first, here's Dr. Anthony Fauci.
We all want to reopen. Everyone understands that. But when you see some of the scenes that were shown just now, that's very troubling because that's inviting there to be an issue. I mean, we are going to see upticks of cases, even under the best of circumstances, when you reopen. We know that. That's something you accept. And what we need to do is have the capability of responding in an effective way, of doing the kind of identification, isolation, and contact tracing. But when you have situations in which you see that type of crowding with no masks and people interacting, that's not prudent. And that's inviting a situation that could get out of control. So I keep, when I get an opportunity to plead with people, understanding you do want to gradually do this, but don't start leapfrogging over some of the recommendations and the guidelines, because that's really tempting fate and asking for trouble.
We're listening to some of the comments of Dr. Anthony Fauci on CNN, his message to the partygoers at the Lake of the Ozarks over Memorial Day weekend.
One of the things that I think the people who are out there frolicking need to realize that when you do that and you see no negative effect in 1 week, please don't be overconfident, because the effect of spreading is not going to be seen for 2, 3, and maybe even more weeks. And at that time, you can have the uptick. And that's the reason why we encourage people, as we want people to be able to have the opportunity to reopen, to be prudent and take a careful look at the guidelines and to the best extent possible to follow them.
Dr. Buchholz, what's your take on what Dr. Fauci just said?
Agree. I really have nothing else to add to that. I think, you know, I think the two salient points is one, be prudent. We are, in this kind of process of kind of unraveling this shelter in place order that we've all been under really for 2 months, if not a little bit longer. And, to go back to just kind of business as usual right after the fact is just, it's insanity. And it kind of makes you think, what was the point in the first place? We're just going to go back and do all this anyway. So, I think that part really just kind of resonates the most with me. But I think the second thing, just in terms of advice, is just still be prudent. You know, this is not the time to take unnecessary risks. It's just kind of a complete aside. I mean, I'm just getting ready to prepare a talk then we give to my colleagues that just deal with people teaching doctors about how COVID has probably fundamentally changed how we go about our work for the future. You know, this is not just like a temporary, kind of pause in what we normally do, but this is a fundamental seismic shift in how we go about teaching future doctors and nurses and everybody else in between. And I think my advice, or at least my thinking with this, has been, where is this else going to fundamentally change our society? And all I can really speak about is healthcare, but I think it kind of goes this thing of this idea of trying to get things back to normal is just, particularly this day, or at this time, is just folly. I mean, maybe it will, but I'm just highly skeptical of that. And, you know, we have to start preparing for the new reality. And the first thing is just saying, look, we don't know how many people have this or have had this. We don't know, and we anticipate further surges in this. And like I said before, I'm really worried about the resiliency of the healthcare system to deal with a spike at this point. We didn't deal with it well the first pass, particularly in cities like New York and New Orleans and Detroit. St. Louis, we got, you know, we were, I don't know if lucky or, you know, we had good policies in place or some combination thereof. But, you know, you look at the headlines, all the major hospital systems in St. Louis are laying off people, and that includes physicians. This morning I was dealing with, and I've been dealing with this on many mornings, is our hospital is full of a lot of sick patients, not COVID patients, very, very ill patients. We're at our kind of capacity already. And like I said, you had 10 or 15 COVID patients that we're overwhelmed. And that's how small the margins are. And I don't think people realize this. And I don't know what it's going to take to get people to realize this. I'm still very nervous about the next few months. And this doesn't help. So that's really what I have to say. Echo those comments. Exactly. I think Dr. Fauci is exactly right.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. And another thing that Dr. Fauci mentioned is that it may take a couple weeks till we know anything. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so again, the way this spreads, again, think about it this way. Just say, just for argument's sake, there is 100 people in that scene that many have seen in the Lake of the Ozarks. Maybe there's one person there that was an asymptomatic spreader or maybe actually even had symptoms. And therefore, let's just say out of theory, half the people in that group are exposed. We're talking about 50 people. You know, the incubation period is about, we think, 5 days or so. So all those people come home and they interact with, say, 10 other people, and half of those people are infected. So now you have the 50 plus 50 times 100, which is 500. Half that now is a 250. And then that takes about 5 days. Those 250 people interact with 10 or 50 people. These are all just, this is just back of the envelope math. It's not really exactly what happened. You know, and so it doubles every 2 to 5 days, depending on how quickly and how much interactions there are. So 250 becomes 500, becomes 1,000, becomes 2,000, becomes 4,000, becomes 8,000. And about, depending on how quickly this goes, in about a 2 to 4 week span. And that's how this explodes, is it just the more people that interact with each other that are asymptomatic spread, and the more people that get infected, the number of known infections just increases at a higher rate. This is why we talk about that R that people talk about. You know, I always talk about doubling time, you know, anywhere to, you know, when we're doubling at less than 2 days, the spread is that much more exponential. This is a whole concept of flattening the curve. So, you know, the idea of this is to reduce exposures as much as possible, which is why Dr. Page recommended a quarantine in St. Louis. You know, people that were in the Ozarks that came back to St. Louis County. Again, I don't know how well we're going to enforce that, but the idea there is at least, well, okay, you've had this exposure, now you limit the spread. That's kind of how the second phase of this is supposed to work. The problem is just enforcing that and having the testing capabilities that are there that, frankly, probably aren't there yet. That makes this more problematic and troubling.
So given the lack of testing and contact tracing, do you think we ever can get a handle on dealing with outbreaks?
That's why I'm nervous. As of now, I'm not sure we can. I don't want to make too many inferences about the people that were there. Maybe they just really didn't understand what was going on. Maybe now they do, and they take this seriously. But if they're ones flouting the rules and they continue to flout the rules, they may very well be the person that you're sitting next to in a restaurant or at a grocery store. That's the problem that compounds this and makes it so much harder to kind of understand. When you don't understand where these people that may be asymptomatic spreaders go, you can't figure out where to kind of troubleshoot and try to narrow or reduce the consequences of this.
Dr. Buchholz, you mentioned that you're working on an address about how the coronavirus has changed how you go about doing your job. How has it changed the way you do your job?
Well, so you know, again, I work in a teaching hospital. So when I go to work and see patients, it's not only me going to the bedside and seeing patients, but I have a team. I have residents who are doctors that graduated medical school that are kind of learning the fine arts of being what I call an internist. This is a physician that takes care of the adult population. That's 3 years of training. So during that time, I usually have three residents with me. Medical students are set to come back on June 1st. And so usually we have medical students with us, and that can be anywhere from two to three medical students. So you can kind of imagine I have this like tribe of people that walk around in this group, and there's, you know, anywhere from in our hospital, we have nine different teams with residents on it that are taking care of patients. So you have these nine clusters of five or six people walking around seeing patients, which we just can't do right now. We want to make sure we're socially distant, and so those big teams are certainly different. What's really wonderful about my job is we may have this really interesting case, and we can talk about it as a group and think about it. And, you know, what I love about my job is, you know, if I'm about to make a mistake, I have eight other people there asking me what I'm about to do and why am I doing this. And if I can't justify it very well, we change tacks, you know, because they've caught my mistake, and I love that. And so some of that redundancy is gone, and that camaraderie and the spirit of working with each other and the team base and the very, you know, stimulating environment, that's gone. You know, we have conferences and lectures where we get together and, you know, learn about something and, you know, socialize and spend some time with each other. We haven't done that since March. We do it by Zoom, but that's, you know, not nearly the same as being in person and seeing a friend you haven't seen in a couple months. So that socialization part is gone. And, you know, I think the AAMC, which is the kind of governing body for medical schools across the country, pulled all medical students off service in March. And that was for good reason. They wanted to protect their students and make sure they weren't put in harm's way. But, you know, kind of in the midst of, you know, probably the most unbelievable healthcare crisis this country has seen in any of our lifetimes, you have a generation of learners that were just basically on the sideline, and they haven't had a chance to practice their clinical skills for about 3 months, which is an important time, particularly, you know, when you're in your third year of medical school. And so how are those people going to be when they go into when they graduate from medical school? You know, how do we still give them the training that they need to have? So they're just all parts of this. And then, you know, some other kind of subtle things is because people can't take the standard tests we give as part of getting our licensing because of social distancing rules, we've kind of postponed those. And so what does that mean for our standards going forward? They're all fascinating questions, and it's just, again, this is just in my small world of teaching doctors, let alone healthcare, let alone our country, let alone the world. I mean, COVID has just been alternately, as I said before, fascinating and terrifying at the same time, but I think it's in my own circle and sphere of influence, it certainly caused huge seismic changes that I don't think we're going to go back. I really don't.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, the CDC has now again clarified its position on the transmission of the coronavirus. What can you tell us? What are they updating?
Yeah. Well, so last week they talked about that they thought that, you know, surfaces was not the main mode of transmission for coronavirus, which is, to be fair, is probably true. What they kind of clarified today is say it is possible, it's just not the most common or most concerning form of transmission. Again, I think as we talked about and continue to talk about, the overwhelming evidence is just, you know, really crowds of people in close proximity for a long duration, and then to some degree air circulation within that proximity probably plays the biggest role. Now, you know, if you think about it, if I have coronavirus and I'm working on my computer and I sneeze on it, you know, don't clean any of it up. And I would never do that, I hope. So one of my partners comes and uses the computer 12 hours after the fact, uses the computer, and then, say, eats their morning coffee and donut and gets some of the coronavirus from the keyboard onto their face. You know, presumably, if they're not washing their hands consistently and they haven't wiped down the surfaces, they could infect themselves. So it is possible. It's just not the most common, highest risk form of transmission.
So people should not get a false sense of security that it's okay to touch any sort of surfaces and not worry about it.
Yeah, no, I think this goes back to consistent hand washing. You know, soap and water is best. Alcohol wipes are sufficient, probably, if you don't have access to soap and water at that point. wiping down services. So, you know, again, I think the policies that you have, again, going to the grocery store where, you know, there's somebody hopefully wiping down the carts, people are washing their hands as they walk in, they're wearing their face masks. I think all those are pretty sound policies at this point to really limit the spread. And I would still suggest doing that. Like I said, the odds of getting infected that way are less than if you're in a big public place like the Lake of the Ozarks this weekend. But it's still potential, and you know, I think it's wise to be prudent and cautious.
The CDC now also says that antibody tests for COVID-19 can be wrong up to half the time. What's going on there?
Well, this is a known property of tests. You know, no test is black and white. And I was trying to come up with an apt analogy, and I'm going to go with this one and see if it works. So if you had a more modern day picture of my, you know, of me, you'd see that I'm incredibly bald, which is a fact. But I do have hair on the side of my head, and probably half of it is gray and half of it is brown, what it used to be. And then my wife, and she'll come in for this, she probably has one or two gray hairs somewhere in her hair, but otherwise she has a luscious head of chestnut brown hair. If you take a sample of my hair, you have a 50-50 shot of it being either gray or brown. And if you take that sample and you got a gray hair, you can conclude that my hair is gray. Or if you got a sample of my brown hair, you conclude that my hair is brown. Whereas if you took my wife and you got a sample of hair and it's brown, you conclude it's brown. Or if you got that one or two strands of gray hair, you would make the conclusion that hair is gray. Now, you listen to this, you say that's absurd. Why do you only check one hair in order to determine whether or not somebody's hair color? But that's what these tests are. It's one test in isolation, and it doesn't take into account all the other possibilities that are there, which is the color of somebody's hair or the number of hairs that somebody has. And so you've got to think, the important part about doing any diagnostic test is thinking about what's the chance of having a disease before that. So as an example with COVID, if I had somebody, you know, that had no symptoms whatsoever, you know, never felt well, had no exposure to COVID that they know of, and you did an antibody test and it was positive, you'd have a harder time determining whether or not they truly had COVID or not, because it's kind of like the gray hair on my wife's head. It just, you have no way of knowing what they're likely to have having symptoms, other than the fact of maybe if you had a sense of how common this was in the country. So if, you know, we can certainly say COVID now is much more common than it was, say, 6 months ago because it didn't exist. That can color your interpretation of it, but you'd still have to be a little cautious about telling that person whether or not they had COVID because they really had no symptoms and you're kind of operating in kind of a information poor environment. Whereas if you have somebody that says they were sick with COVID, they had the classic symptoms, they tested positive for the nasal swab, and you got an antibody test and it was positive, you could say, okay, well, we see clearly you had COVID, now you have antibodies to it, and that's pretty helpful. But if they didn't have antibodies or they tested negative, that would be testing my hair, because you don't know whether I'm gray or brown. There's a 50-50 shot. You're pretty certain of where things are. You have much more. You've seen a picture of me. You have a better idea of what my hair looks like, and you can still make pretty good inferences on that based on having more information about that. And that's the point. No test in isolation is helpful. And anybody, doctor or the layperson that uses one test to make a decision about anything, in my mind, is not an experienced person that knows what they're doing. We have to take all this information in the context of this one test and do that. And the other kind of caveat with this is there's lots of people putting antibody tests because there's a pressure and an interest to do this. And they're all of variable quality, too, which makes it much, much harder. The one we've used in my institution at St. Louis University Hospital, we tested quite a bit to get people we know who had coronavirus, people we know who didn't, and had some pretty good validity with that. So it's helpful. We've tried some others too, and they've been very inaccurate. So there's a huge range of quality of the test too, which is another confounding factor. This is what makes medicine hard, Fred. I mean, it's not just the test by itself. It's all the interpretation and understanding of the math behind it. That's incredibly important. And frankly, doctors don't always get it right either. So, you know, I'm not saying we're perfect in that. We get it wrong frequently.
Dr. Buchholz, I have a listener question for you today, and I think it's something that you brought up a bit earlier, but maybe you just can tell us more about it. This listener wants to know, what is R-naught, and why is it important to the country reopening?
Yeah, so in simplistic terms, it just basically is a measure of how quickly cases are occurring. So it's not a perfect measure. There's some other ones, and again, I mentioned about this too, of something called doubling time, which is a little bit more, I would say, less sophisticated, but I think more easy to understand. It's just basically how many, you know, doubling time is just how many days there are between the doubling of COVID cases. So way back in late March and early April, if you looked at the cases, say, just in St. Louis, we were doubling the number of cases every couple of days, which means, again, that scenario I gave way back earlier where all these people from the Lake Ozarks come back and then they interact with other people, the more people they interact, the more quickly we're going to have cases occur, and that's going to occur at a rapid rate. And then, therefore, that exponential number occurs, you know, that doubling occurs every 2 days instead of every 5 or 6 days. R is kind of a similar metric where it just is kind of expressing that in a ratio to say, is the number of cases increasing enough to kind of cause an exponential spread or a spread that you know, causes more and more people at a much faster rate than we can kind of keep up with or try to limit without putting in pretty drastic measures like social distancing or shelter in place orders. So you can track that in different populations, and if that ratio goes below one, that means it's not doubling fast enough to kind of get out of hand, so to speak. And so once you get below that one, you can start to say, okay, well, we've got a handle on this. Now we can start thinking about how we kind of loosen up the measures. And again, loosening it up to the point that you still keep that number under one, that's the art of this. This is where public health expertise and, you know, good policy comes into play. I mean, if you just let everything go, which is what we saw over the weekend, we go back to, you know, square one really quickly. And that's, I think, the frustrating and troubling part about that. The numbers as good as the policies behind that. And that's what's really important on thinking about all this.
Dr. Buckle, thanks a lot for all your time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for letting me talk about some things really near and dear to my heart, which is testing and medical education. Those are what I based my career on. So you hit my wheelhouse today, Fred.
Good deal. Every once in a while, I get a hit. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, doctor.
All right.
Dr. Fred Buckle is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. And that's all the time we have for today's podcast, Coronavirus Facts Only. This is KMOX health editor Fred Bottomer. Thanks a lot for listening, and please join us again tomorrow.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.